Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Dalia Adia King, founder and CEO of Panacea. Dalia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Matt. I'm actually super excited to be here today.
So, Dalia, what I always like to do before getting into the main part of my conversation is to give my guests a chance to provide more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So, Dalia, the floor is yours.
Awesome. Thank you. So, as you said, my name is Dalia Adia King, and I am the founder and CEO of a company called Panacea. And our mission at Panacea is essentially to make valuable life-saving clinical genetic testing more accessible and affordable to anyone and everyone that wants it. And so I live and breathe genetic testing and genetics in healthcare and in the healthcare business side of things.
Yeah, so that's going to be a lot to unpack. But before we get to that, the other question I always like to ask is, what first got you into healthcare as the industry and kind of as your professional focus?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I really have wanted to be in healthcare and essentially be a doctor since I could remember. My father's a doctor, my grandfather's a doctor. So science and medicine is very much ingrained in, you know, who I am and what I've been exposed to my whole life. And so I was pre-med at the University of Miami with the intention of going to medical school. And I was literally putting together my medical school applications when I got a totally obscure opportunity to work at a small group of genetic laboratories. And my education obviously was heavily, you know, revolving around genetics, obviously, as a bio major and a chem minor. And I took the opportunity just to kill some time, literally, as I was putting my applications together. And very quickly, I learned all about the chaos that existed in the genetic space in healthcare and healthcare kind of overall. And what I learned was that very few people were able to access this life-saving, you know, sometimes life-saving clinical test called genetic testing. And it was primarily for really ridiculous reasons, like, you know, insurance companies weren't covering it for patients, or doctors didn't necessarily know how to use it or order it or interpret the results. And so they just declined, you know, ordering it for their patients. And so I couldn't look away from that train wreck, because obviously genetics is a core part of the future of healthcare, right? Precision medicine, personalized care, all kind of revolves around genetics. And if we couldn't get the basics of genetics in the hands of people, like genetic testing, then our future kind of was in jeopardy, I suppose. And so I decided, being bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, that I was going to change this. And I sort of delved in and started talking to everyone and anyone that would talk to me and learned about all the problems in the space and, you know, came up with a solution. Of course, not overnight. It took years and years and years to kind of come up with a solution that ultimately became Panacea. But that's kind of how I ended up in my current role.
Yeah, so it kind of opens up the question of, you know, when you're talking about genetics and genetic testing, what do you actually mean? Because it's, you know, maybe some people remember back to, for me, distant days, or maybe some other people not quite distant days, but like biology class in high school, I remember the fruit flies and kind of the basics on that front. But, yes. You know, I'm guessing you're thinking about it a little bit more in depth than that, or maybe you're not. Maybe it's kind of all, it does build off of that. So, you know, kind of, if you can, just help level set for us what you actually mean by genetics and genetic testing.
Yeah, so genetic testing in the most basic form, really, or definition, is the analysis and review of an individual's genes, right? Why is that even relevant or important? Well, our genes carry essentially all the biological instruction that our cells kind of obey, right? The terms and conditions, right, of biology kind of live in our genes. And if we can understand what our genes are kind of holding or carrying, we could really have a better understanding of how that might translate into our health, right? Our susceptibility for disease, or our, you know, risk for developing certain problems. And so it's a really, really valuable information tool, right? It's clue gathering. And so that's why genetic testing, I think, is so valuable in healthcare and in disease prevention, right? Because it kind of gives you insight into what could happen. And then you can sort of plan around that, plan a very targeted approach to preventing a problem that could arise, or even eliminating the problem in some cases.
And when you're talking about, you know, potentially being able to predict what that medical history might be, or what someone's, you know, healthcare journey could be, you know, what level of accuracy or, you know, kind of comfort do we have, or does science currently have, when it comes to understanding what different genes might do?
Yeah. So clinical genetic testing in, you know, the prevention context is sort of a risk assessment, right? It isn't something that is written in stone or a certainty. If you have a certain variation of a gene, what that does is it gives us an understanding of how likely you are to develop a problem that essentially is inscribed in your genes. And so, again, it's really about clue building. It's about having access to information that gives you, you know, a better data set to work with. And so I think in the clinical context, I think it's just extremely valuable to have those clues in front of you, because you can essentially, you know, take action and sort of get ahead of some of these problems.
So you kind of talked about, you know, the clinical testing, creating additional data sets and providing more information that helps continue to create a bigger, broader picture of each individual. So I think, as you're kind of implying, that helps support the direction that is trying to go, where we're creating more personalized medicine and personalized care, which requires us to have more information about each individual. So I guess maybe taking a step back, like when we're talking about kind of clinical genetic testing, how do you actually conduct that testing?
So clinical genetic testing, essentially, like any, you know, genetic testing, will require a tissue sample. And that's usually either blood or saliva. And most modern laboratories today are really doing a great job of being able to extract DNA from saliva. And it's a much, you know, simpler, less invasive, better user experience to just donate some saliva. And that saliva is essentially taken to a lab, and the labs have a very incredible way of extracting DNA from that very tiny sample of saliva. And that DNA is put into a machine, and that machine kind of breaks up the DNA into millions of pieces, and it simultaneously sequences those pieces. And the great thing about that is, because you have millions of pieces of DNA that are being sequenced simultaneously, the time that it takes to sequence an entire genome is slashed significantly. And also the cost is slashed significantly. And so thanks to the advent of next-gen sequencing, we're sort of able to have genetic testing as, you know, sort of a feasible tool in healthcare today.
So kind of, I think, as you said, the technology has evolved to help reduce, you know, the time to conduct it, and then correspondingly that's reduced the cost. So does that mean that genetic testing is something that's been around for a longer period of time, maybe with just less awareness?
You know, that's an interesting point that you bring up. So genetic sequencing isn't really a new thing, right? It's been around, obviously, for decades, you know, thanks to Mary Claire King, the discovery of the BRCA gene, which, of course, is associated with some types of breast cancers, was discovered in the mid-90s. And then the Human Genome Project, of course, which was, I think, concluded in 2003, used genetic sequencing. Genetic testing per se and genetic sequencing is not necessarily a novel thing. But what has really made genetic testing far more accessible feasible as far as a test utilized in healthcare is next-gen sequencing. And next-gen sequencing has, of course, as I mentioned, slashed the cost and the time in which it takes to sequence a genome. I think next-gen sequencing sort of came onto the scene in the late 2000s. I think the FDA approved Illumina's next-gen sequencing machines in 2013. So it's really only been a decade, to your point, where genetic testing in medicine has really been feasible. And one could argue that really it's not well integrated yet in healthcare. A decade is actually kind of a short time in healthcare to kind of introduce a novel technology and get physicians trained on it and get insurance to kind of approve it and implement it in their offering. So in a way, in a sense, genetic testing, you know, accessibility and feasibility in healthcare is relatively recent.
Yeah, and to the point that you just made that, you know, healthcare and medicine can be, you know, call it slow to adopt novel technology. You know, in the particular case of the genetic testing, you know, have you noticed particular barriers to that adoption? And then at the same time, you know, what do you see as signs that adoption might be starting to tick up?
Yeah, great question. So interestingly, you will find few people in healthcare that argue its efficacy or value. Everyone seems to be on board with the fact that genetic testing is an incredible tool, not only for diagnostic purposes, but for prevention. The barriers, ironically, and I think this really shocked me and my team when we were sort of trying to understand the problems in this space and why the use of genetic testing was so limited. The problems really center around two major issues. Number one, the insurance coverage for universal testing is really, really patchy. Insurers are, you know, trying to expand coverage, I think, for genetic testing for more people. But let's call a spade a spade. Insurance coverage is still really, really patchy. So that's an enormous barrier. If your insurer is not going to cover a service for you, most people are just not going to get the service. Secondly, and this is partly I think one of the most heartbreaking parts is physicians themselves are part of the barrier. And it's not really because, again, they don't find value in genetic testing or, you know, they don't think that it could help patients. I think physicians are mostly a little apprehensive to utilize genetic testing in the care of their patients for two primary reasons. Number one, they really don't have a tremendous amount of training on genetics and genetic testing. And so, rightfully so, they don't really want to prescribe a test that they may not really feel comfortable understanding or interpreting the results for. And then secondly, they know the difficulty that the patient is going to face in battling their insurers. Most people are not going to have coverage for insurance, for testing with their insurance company. So those two barriers, physician apprehensiveness and the lack of universal coverage for genetic testing, are really the biggest barriers of access to genetic testing today.
Yeah, and I think kind of as you pointed out, they're certainly intertwined because, you know, I think you pointed out that part of that apprehension might be knowing that, you know, the patient might face a fight to get that coverage. But mm-hmm. kind of, you know, pulling that apart a little bit, I think you mentioned in terms of the coverage that the coverage of universal testing is patchy. So, you know, what do you actually mean by universal testing? And is there other types of testing that maybe there is more coverage for?
Yeah. Okay. So let me clarify that a little bit. So today, in order for a patient to really receive coverage for a genetic test with their insurer, they have to sort of fit into certain criteria. Basically, they have to meet the guidelines that are recommended. The guidelines require that an individual either has a personal history of cancer below a certain age, and or they have a pretty severe family history of related cancers. And so if you don't check the boxes for those things, insurance will kind of look at you and say, well, you're not really high risk, and therefore you don't really qualify for insurance coverage for genetic testing. Now, guidelines are necessary. Totally get it. You know, universal testing for almost, you know, anything would be sometimes overkill and very, very costly. But the problem that we're facing is that most physicians, unfortunately, are not really even following the basic guidelines that are given. In addition to that, studies are showing that the guidelines themselves, as they are, currently miss half of the people that ultimately have genetic variations that can lead to a disease. So it's kind of a failure on all fronts, these guidelines and the criteria. They're not being followed. And even when they are being followed, they're missing half the people. So the only real solution would be universal testing, which basically means anyone and everyone can get tested. The costs for that are coming down tremendously. The costs for genetic testing, you know, are becoming much more affordable, as we discussed, because of next-gen sequencing. And so it is feasible to universally test, or at least test more widely for people. But unfortunately, if you do some digging and some research with the insurance companies, genetic testing in and of itself doesn't really fit into their financial model. It is not that they don't see benefit, and it is not that they don't think it's going to save lives. It's simply that it just unfortunately doesn't fit into their business model. And so that's really what hinders that universal testing.
Yeah. And without getting too cynical, it's, you know, I feel like that unfortunately can become a fairly common argument across healthcare. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Dalia Tia King from Panacea, and we're talking about genetic testing, kind of its development. And Dalia, as you're kind of talking about, you know, that increased feasibility of being able to have more widespread testing, you know, you've been talking a lot about the actual clinical efficacy and clinical usage of the genetic testing, but I think a lot of people probably have heard of, I will call it more consumer-facing style genetic testing. You know, some of those companies might be advertising their services in a lot of places. So, you know, kind of what impact have those companies had on, you know, the understanding of what genetic testing is and kind of the benefits that it can bring?
Sure. So, you know, the net positive, the net effect, I should say, of a lot of these direct-to-consumer companies that are offering quote-unquote genetic testing is overall positive. I think companies like, you know, 23andMe and Ancestry and all of these companies that, you know, we're very familiar with have sort of been able to bring genetic testing to the average Joe, which I think is revolutionary. They've been able to sort of introduce the conversation about genetics and how the understanding of your own genetics could help you in so many ways. And so I think what they've been able to do is really, really incredible. The area where I think they may have fallen short a smidge is I don't think they've sort of been very transparent about the limitations of their type of testing. Genetic testing comes in many flavors, right? And the type of testing that direct-to-consumer companies offer kind of centers around a technology called microarray. And microarray is a very surface level, kind of cheap type of genetic testing. And it's not an actual reading or sequencing of a gene. It's kind of a search and find for a very specific sequence of genes or order of a piece of a gene. And so you don't really, they don't find what they're not looking for. And, you know, without being transparent about the limitations, most people, I think, walk away with a false sense of security when they get a direct to consumer test, because they think, oh, I did a genetic test, I'm good. And when in fact they don't realize they did a genetic test that barely looked at their genes, right? So in a way, I think what they've been able to do is tremendous and very beneficial for genetics as a whole and for people as a whole, because now people have access to this information. But I think they need to do a better job of explaining what their type of testing does not reveal and inform people on the limitations of that type of test so that people can actually seek other types of tests out that might reveal all the information that could really help their healthcare and maybe even save their lives.
No, that's very interesting. So just to make sure that, you know, I'm understanding correctly, you know, and obviously using extremely broad, kind of broad strokes to summarize it, you know, it sounds like maybe the direct-to-consumer is taking more of a hunt and peck type of approach of looking at someone's genes where they're trying to maybe match it up against particular findings that might have a specific importance attached to it, whereas the kind of more true clinical testing sounds like it's broader based and doing an actual full sequencing and not just looking, maybe trying to hone in on one or two things.
That's exactly right. Here's one of the best analogies I have. Let's say you have a document and a digital document in Word, and you are looking for a very specific word, you know, a name of somebody, let's just say. And you control find, right? You type in that word and that word gets highlighted in the entire document, right? You know exactly where the word is. You take the word out or you do what you have, right? What you want to do with that word. That's essentially what microarray technology does for genetics. It's a search and find. Now, next-gen sequencing, as you were saying, is an actual sequencing and reading of your genes. So that's comparable to me saying, hey, Matt, could you read me this book? But instead of reading me every word in this book, I want you to sound out every letter of every word of every sentence of every paragraph on every page in this book. So the depth and breadth of information that's extracted from next-gen sequencing versus microarray is massive. And that's exactly why next-gen sequencing is usually the preferred method for clinical testing, because it really just doesn't miss anything. It's very thorough.
Yeah, no, that I think that's a really great analogy, because as you said, it really helps to, you know, I think break it down and show or help to explain the kind of complete differences. So kind of thinking about that, you know, like that seems like it's going to create a lot of data that comes out of it. So kind of what happens with all that data?
It does. Next-gen sequencing certainly does create more data, but there's also subtypes of next-gen sequencing, right? So there are tests called panel tests, and those are the most commonly ordered types of clinical genetic tests. Panel tests are essentially cherry-picked genes that are sequenced and read. It is not a sequencing of the entire genome or the entire exome. So the data that comes off of panel tests, of course, is much larger than, you know, microarray tests, but still more limited because you're cherry picking maybe 50 genes, 100 genes, however many, right? With whole exome and whole genome data, which is a much more thorough, comprehensive sequencing of either all of your gene library, which is whole exome, or whole genome, which is not only your gene library, but the spaces of genetic information in between your genes, the information that comes off of that is massive. Yeah. So that information you know, for the most part, is very, very useful in drug development and research. And a lot of companies ultimately do share that data or even monetize that data, you know, by selling it to pharma or research. And the hopes, of course, is that that information will be used for good in the advancement of drugs and medical therapeutics that hopefully can, you know, save lives and treat disease.
Yeah, and kind of in the face of, you know, all those potential benefits and, you know, that potential utilization of the data, you know, I feel like in healthcare and really kind of more broadly, you can't get away from privacy concerns at this point in time. So kind of, you know, from your perspective, where does privacy fit into it and kind of what protections have you seen within the industry and or kind of what awareness of privacy have you seen within the industry for, you know, that needs to be applied to this data that's being created?
The privacy, the protection of the data itself, I think most companies, to be honest with you, are doing as good of a job as they can. But the bottom line is there is no way of 100%, you know, there's no fail safe method in protecting data in this day and age, especially if that data is sitting on a database that's connected to the internet. So these are the realities, right? It's almost impossible to fully protect this information. I think the question that we need to ask ourselves is, well, what can really be done to harm me with this, with you know, a data breach, right? The answer, even when it comes to genetics, is not much, to be honest with you. Your raw genetic data, if it's sitting on a server somewhere, you know, from a DNA company, there's not much that can be done with it. Not even a pharmaceutical company or a research institution is going to just buy raw data. Your data is only valuable when it comes with much more context. The disease history of the person whose genome that is, the health history, the family health history. It's the context that really gives value to that genome data. And so the genome data itself, even if it's compromised or accessed, I don't really know what truly can be done with it. It's not super valuable. I don't know if that, you know, maybe puts some people's minds at ease or if it scares people even more, but the bottom line is it's just really not much can be done with it.
That's very interesting, but it kind of, I think all those different kind of facets that you pointed out demonstrate that, you know, probably more needs to be thought about the approach. And, you know, again, this probably applies broadly to any privacy issue. It's, you know, time to make some type of a reassessment and reevaluation of, you know, what protections are required, what protections could be required, what might not be needed, and kind of how the, you know, all these different forms of data could be used. So it's, you know, just, I think a lot to kind of break down and then, you know, actually construct, you know, a new approach around that reassessment. But Dalia, believe it or not, we're actually already out of time. So I want to thank my guest, Dalia Tia King, for a great conversation today.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here. And this was awesome.
Yes. And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.